Good afternoon and welcome to today's program at the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Paul Carroll. I'm the program director of the Plowshares Fund here in San Francisco, and I'll be your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Thomas Countryman, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Nonproliferation. Now, Tom has a very long and distinguished career, and I hope that some of you have read his bio that was posted online. It's quite distinguished and long. And when I look at government service and military service of many of the people that come and speak to us here, rather than just sort of read a laundry list of where they were and what they did, I find it really interesting to look at where they were and when they were there. Because Tom's service, he didn't take the easy path, let's put it that way. I find it to be very impressive that he was in Yugoslavia in the mid-1980s when we were at the twilight of the Soviet Union. And of course, we didn't know this at the time, but it was upon us and the swirls of it were upon him, I'm sure. He was in Tunisia and Egypt around the time of Desert Shield and Desert Storm, supporting UNSCOM, or the UN inspection regime in Iraq, and supported Madeleine Albright when she was our ambassador to the UN in the mid and late 1990s. He then spent a number of years in South and Central Europe, including foreign policy support to the Commandant of the U.S. Marines as recently as 2008 and 2009. So again, interesting places, interesting times. Currently, Tom serves at the State Department's International Security and Nonproliferation Bureau, essentially responsible for the department's efforts to identify and prevent the spread of nuclear, chemical, biological, and conventional weapons. The prospects that more of these weapons will spread across the globe are obviously an international security threat. Now, Tom is originally from Tacoma, Washington, but he was educated at the Washington University in St. Louis. Sorry, Cardinals fans. And he also has some strong Bay Area connections, too. His parents apparently met while they were students at Cal. Sorry, Stanford Cardinal fans. Today, Tom will speak to us about these security risks and how his team and our government is working to address them. He will also discuss how the nature of weapons of mass destruction and conventional weapons proliferation has changed. And finally, though it may seem very much a surprise to you, he's going to offer ways that you, as individuals, can help in the effort to reduce these risks. Please join me now in welcoming Tom Countryman.
Paul, I was a Giants fan from the time I first followed baseball. But thank you, Paul, for a very generous introduction. And let me both thank and salute the Plowshares Fund for the smart and strategic approach that they take to building a safer and more secure world. And, of course, I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me here today. It's humbling to stand here when you look at the long list of people who have had this honor, including my current boss, the acting undersecretary for arms control and international security, Rose Gottemuller. It is a great tradition of bringing together some of the greatest minds to discuss our most urgent issues, and I will do my best not to detract from that tradition. It's a privilege for me to talk to you today about one of the greatest challenges that face all of us, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the transfer of destabilizing conventional weapons. There's no better place to have this conversation than here in the Bay Area. Here, this region is home to some of the world's best research universities, the most innovative technology and life science firms around, leading national laboratories, including Lawrence Livermore, where I was the last couple days. They were the host this week to the G8 Nonproliferation Directors Group meeting. The United States is the chair of the G8 process this year, so colleagues from seven nations joined me yesterday to discuss exactly these issues. not coincidentally, it was a great excuse for me to get out of Washington and off to the coast I prefer. 50 years ago, the world waited perilously close to the brink of nuclear war to see if President Kennedy and his senior advisors could reach a peaceful resolution to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Of course, the Cold War is long over. The possibility of nuclear war with the Soviet Union has all but disappeared. Our kids no longer need to worry that their world could be destroyed overnight in a single flash of light. But while the threat of nuclear war between the countries has receded, the world that the new generation will inherit is more complex and in some ways more dangerous. Think of the challenge. Insurgents, terrorists, criminals, drug cartels already have access to small arms and light weapons. The illicit market for conventional weapons is a $6 billion enterprise that affects security and regional stability around the world. But in addition to the demand for conventional weapons, the demand for the world's worst weapons, weapons of mass destruction, while hardly widespread, now includes also terrorist groups with catastrophic ambitions. Imagine what would happen if they also had ready access to weapons of mass destruction. Just one nuclear weapon exploding in San Francisco or any other city could potentially kill hundreds of thousands of people. Now, it takes some real skill, but the knowledge and materials and equipment that are required to make at least a crude chemical weapon or biological weapon are both attainable and relatively inexpensive. We should be thankful that building nuclear weapons and their delivery systems is a more complex undertaking that requires significantly more resources, including advanced scientific and technical expertise. But even here, individuals motivated by ideology or profit are willing to support countries that thumb their nose at the international non-proliferation norms. More than a decade ago, Osama bin Laden proclaimed that acquiring weapons of mass destruction for the defense of Muslims is a religious duty. Several retired nuclear scientists met with al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan only a month prior to the 9/11 attacks. Keeping the world's most dangerous weapons out of the hands of the most dangerous individuals is job one for the International and Security and Nonproliferation Bureau of the State Department. It's a sobering challenge, but I take great comfort in knowing that the U.S. not only has a long tradition in leading the world in meeting this challenge, but that I have this job under an administration that's gone to such great lengths to emphasize the importance of nonproliferation to our national security. President Obama has devoted more of his time, his study, and his political capital to this issue than previous presidents. In his first major foreign policy address in Prague in 2009, he declared our country's commitment to stopping the spread of nuclear weapons as part of his long-term vision of a world without nuclear weapons. He said a nuclear-free world is not something that we can or should try to achieve immediately by ourselves or without the closest cooperation with our partners. But over time, small steps can lead to a big change for the better. Building on the accomplishments of previous administrations, we've continued that journey by taking concrete steps to reduce stockpiles of nuclear weapons, to secure vulnerable nuclear materials better, and to develop and implement plans that make it harder for terrorists to get their hands on them. Today, I want to describe the changing nature of nonproliferation work and discuss the dynamic programs and partnerships that we've established in the U.S. and internationally to realize the President's Prague agenda. Let me give first a thumbnail sketch of the changing proliferation threat. For decades, the proliferation of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons and their means of delivery was a state problem that governments addressed by international agreements between states, such as the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Biological Weapons Convention, and the Chemical Weapons Convention. These legal instruments and the international organizations that monitor them and the export control regimes that reinforce them and the related international sanctions to discourage cheating, all of these tools seek to curb proliferation by national governments around the world. And during the Cold War, states were, of course, the likely source of and destination for weapons of mass destruction. Few countries possessed the resource and know-how to produce WMD, and only a few more felt the need to seek such capabilities, given the security guarantees in place from the two superpowers. After the Cold War, after the fragmentation of the Soviet Union, countries like North Korea and Iran have emerged as traditional threats in this category. But the more important trend is that the advent of globalization has contributed to the erosion of national sovereignty. Mass communications and information sharing technology decentralized power down to non-state actors, giving rise to, as Tom Friedman has said in his writing, super empowered individuals with the tools to threaten international security like never before. The proliferation challenge has fundamentally evolved from an exclusively state problem to a network problem. It includes states, but it also includes unscrupulous scientists, engineers, businessmen, and brokers around the world. The story of the AQCON proliferation network illustrates this new dynamic. Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan is a Pakistani nuclear scientist and metallurgist who gained illicit access to sensitive uranium enrichment designs through a position that he held in Europe. As you know, uranium enrichment can be used for peaceful nuclear energy production or, in a highly enriched state, for nuclear weapons. Khan, the father of Pakistan's bomb, built an international proliferation network that used front countries and deceptive transshipment to elude detection. He and his colleagues, who had contacts across the globe, contributed to nuclear weapons programs in Pakistan, Iran, North Korea, and Libya. Now, this network was taken down in 2003, and he was arrested and later confessed his crimes on Pakistani television. Some of his associates around the world, but not all, have been prosecuted or convicted of these crimes. But Khan himself is now running for a seat in Pakistan's parliament and has disavowed his earlier confession. The story of the AQCON network shows how a determined figure and his colleagues can take advantage of modern technology, exploit international weaknesses in trade controls, and conceal illicit WMD materials to spread the world's deadliest technology. Indeed, tracking down and securing these kinds of sensitive items in the complex international market is like finding a needle in a haystack. Fortunately, we have developed collaborative approaches to confront these challenges. First, within our government, we've broken through the bureaucratic stovepipes to create well-coordinated interagency approaches to non-proliferation. I can honestly say that the cooperation and communication across U.S. agencies in Washington is stronger than I have seen at any time in 30 years in government. And the collaboration goes well beyond the executive branch. The Cooperative Threat Reduction Program was initiated by Senators Sam Nunn and Richard Lugar after the fall of the Soviet Union, and it's the best example of a bipartisan, far-sighted, whole-of-government success story when it comes to safeguarding materials and equipment needed to develop such weapons. From its first focus on Russia 20 years ago and the other former Soviet states, the Nunn-Lugar program has expanded to other parts of the world and is evolving towards a focus also on reduction of the biological threat. I'm confident that both the United States and Russia will maintain the political will that we need to complete important unfinished business. It is the Department of Defense through the Defense Threat Reduction Agency that leads the Nunn-Lugar program, but again, other U.S. agencies, such as my bureau within the Department of State, work extraordinarily closely with the Department of Defense to plan and support mutually reinforcing efforts. Similarly, the Department of Energy has nonproliferation programs that aim to secure nuclear and radiological materials and strengthen the capability of foreign governments to detect and prevent international trafficking in forbidden goods. My bureau does its part to address this threat, as well as developing the expertise needed to address it. We help countries to establish and improve and enforce controls over trade and transfer of weapons and related dual-use items. We engage scientists who have the skills in these areas so that they can put their expertise to use for peaceful purposes. We help countries to secure the laboratories where deadly biological pathogens are studied, and we work with countries around the world to be prepared to prevent smuggling of nuclear material. Sometimes unexpected nonproliferation and disarmament opportunities present themselves, such as those set in motion by the Arab Spring of the last 2 years. And to stay ready, my bureau has a rapid response fund to exploit these unique windows of opportunities to move quickly to remove dangerous weapons and equipment, often in very difficult political environments. Now, diplomacy is the main business of the State Department, which brings me to the next point. Beyond developing the capabilities within the U.S. government, we see today unprecedented interest and cooperation across governments around the world in preventing the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. In 2010, President Obama called together the world's first ever nuclear security summit to address the challenge of keeping the world's nuclear materials out of terrorist hands. More than 40 nations gathered in Washington in April 2010, the largest meeting of world leaders on American soil since the UN Charter was signed here in San Francisco in 1945. Those nations committed themselves to lock down vulnerable nuclear material within 4 years and to take specific steps to prevent nuclear smuggling. And we have made considerable progress on these goals since 2010. By the second summit, held this year in Seoul, South Korea, more than 480 kilograms of highly enriched uranium were removed from 8 countries. For safe disposal. That's enough material to produce about 19 nuclear weapons. Ukraine, Mexico, and Serbia accomplished a total clean-out of their entire HEU stockpiles, returning them to Russia and the United States. In the 2 years since the Washington summit, we have converted the equivalent of 3,000 nuclear weapons in Russia and the United States from highly enriched uranium to harmless, low-enriched uranium. In Seoul this year, countries agreed to additional commitments so that 2 years from now, when we gather in the Netherlands for a third nuclear security summit, we will be able to demonstrate even greater progress towards securing nuclear materials and denying them to terrorists. The cornerstone of our diplomatic efforts is the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Following the 1962 Cuban crisis, a confrontation that President Kennedy said at the time left a 1 in 3 chance of nuclear war, he saw the possibility that as early as a decade later, his successor would have to face a world in which 15 or 20 or 25 nations might have these weapons. Thanks in large part to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that dire prediction never came to pass. Today, 189 countries have agreed to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, despite the fact that many of them have the capability to build them. Why is the NPT proven to be such a success in discouraging the spread of nuclear weapons? Well, at its heart, the NPT offers the following bargain. States that have nuclear weapons commit to reduce their and eventually eliminate their arsenals. States that don't have nuclear weapons commit not to acquire them. And all states can share in the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. Now, 3 years ago in Prague, the president affirmed the fundamental soundness of this bargain and the central role of the Non-Proliferation Treaty for international cooperation. We take this commitment seriously, bolstered by the president's personal interest in the topic, and we've worked hard to strengthen the treaty's regime, the NPT regime. In 2010, at the review conference of the NPT, the U.S. worked closely with others to build global confidence in the regime and to build support for enhanced methods to detect and deter efforts to pursue covert nuclear weapons. For the first time in 10 years, in 2010, all the NPT members reached a consensus on a detailed action plan covering each of the three pillars of the treaty: disarmament, non-proliferation, and the peaceful use of nuclear energy. Some of those elements agreed in 2010 include the entry into force of the U.S.-Russian New START Treaty and universal adherence to the additional protocol of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And the plan also provides support, as promised by Secretary Clinton at that conference, to a new initiative by the Atomic Energy to raise $100 million over 5 years for peaceful nuclear applications, not just in energy and medicine, but in things that are hard for us to imagine, in human health, in water management, in agriculture, and in other fields. The U.S. is determined to lead by example in keeping our side of the NPT bargain. The historic Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty, New START, commits both the United States and Russia to further reductions in our nuclear stockpiles, bringing them down to the lowest level since the 1950s. We continue to talk with Russia about even further nuclear reductions, and the president has made clear that we can do this while still ensuring the security of the United States and our allies. We do all of this, and we also pursue ratification in the Senate of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And we are also looking forward to a path towards a new treaty that verifiably ends the production of materials for nuclear treaty, the so-called fissile material cutoff treaty. Now, as part of our leadership on nonproliferation, we work patiently and persistently with the international community to encourage all parties to work towards the regional conditions that would allow the creation of a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. Other regions of the world, South America, Africa, Southeast Asia, the South Pacific, have created such nuclear weapons-free zones. The Middle East is harder. Ultimately, only the states in the region can create the right kind of atmosphere and dialogue that will enable them to make progress on this goal. It is elusive, given the very unsettled regional environment in the Middle East today, but it remains the goal of the United States to initiate this process in a way that involves all the states of the Middle East. Now, not all countries comply with their obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. North Korea announced its withdrawal in 2003, and both Iran and Syria remain out of compliance with their obligations. To deal with those who don't play by the rules, we have rallied the international community to apply sustained and meaningful pressure through a series of United Nations resolutions, as well as with strong action of our own. In the case of Iran, American leadership has enabled us to rally global support for strong and effective sanctions to censure Iran for violating its obligations and to press Iran's leaders to fulfill those commitments and to negotiate seriously about its nuclear program. I think one of the most remarkable achievements of the last few years is something I would not have predicted possible 3 years ago, a consensus within the European Union that they would boycott Iranian oil even at a time of economic stress. And I think this is a success for the international community. We also seek to lead international efforts to address the evolving threat I described earlier, the intent by non-states, by individuals or groups, to acquire such weapons. Treaties that were conceived primarily as barriers to states' acquisition of such weapons have added relevance in today's world. We're now more focused than ever on using our treaty obligations to require governments to prevent the acquisition or use of these weapons by anyone on their territories, not only the governments. These are reinforced by additional efforts from the United Nations. President George Bush led a groundbreaking initiative that resulted in Security Council Resolution 1540, which requires all states to develop and enforce measures to protect sensitive materials, as well as to prevent illicit access to weapons of mass destruction. And over the last 4 years, my bureau continues to support this initiative. We provided $3 million in funds this year to help smaller states set up the necessary framework they need to have these controls in place. We also work to stop trafficking of weapons of mass destruction through the Proliferation Security Initiative, another effort initiated in the Bush administration, which establishes a more coordinated and effective basis for preventing known shipments of WMD materials. Just a couple of months ago, the Dominican Republic became the 101st participant in this voluntary multilateral effort. And we seek to address nuclear terrorism through a joint American-Russian effort, the Global Initiative to Combat Nuclear Terrorism. This now includes 85 nations and four international organizations, and it helps countries to build up the means to detect and respond to acts of nuclear terrorism. 1540, PSI, GICNT, NPT sounds like a lot of alphabet soup, but in fact, these are the tools that are not uniquely American tools, but that represent a consensus and a determination on the part of the international community to prevent the spread of these weapons. We face the challenge of terrorists seeking weapons of mass destruction, of states like Iran and North Korea who are well along that road, but also a real danger of regional nuclear and missile arms race. More nuclear material, more nuclear weapons in more places means less certainty, less security. So we seek to encourage all nations to exercise restraint in their nuclear programs and to take steps that build confidence and trust and thereby reduce the risk of nuclear exchanges. Talking to each other is, of course, critical to improving this mutual understanding. So we also lead efforts to engage in in-depth dialogues, both formally and informally, with countries like India, Pakistan, and China on these and related issues. So I hope I leave you with a greater understanding of the challenges to our national security and to international peace and how the U.S. government works every day to address them. Let me say a word about the role of industry, of civil society, of academics. One of the big lessons we learned from the AQCON proliferation network is that such proliferation cannot be tackled by governments alone, not in a globalized world with super-empowered individuals, with modern technology, and with massive speed-of-light flows of goods and capital. Firms that manufacture dual-use items, items that have both commercial and military applications, shipping companies, freight forwarding companies, banks, other corporate entities all made a contribution, many of them unknowingly, to the success of the AQCON network. Everyone with the awareness can play a positive role. So today we team up with universities to provide training to border control and customs officials from other nations. We build a network of non-proliferators through our outreach to strategic industries in high-tech fields in the United States and around the world. And we train foreign officials so that they have the latest know-how, the best practices, and that they can share these with the private sector in other countries. It extends even to insurance companies, shippers, insurance classification societies. All of these today play a big role in implementing sanctions against Iran and North Korea. And non-governmental organizations serve an important purpose in bringing to light high-quality research, keeping the public informed and engaged, and pushing the non-proliferation agenda into the public consciousness all around the world. So if you have ideas or solutions from your community that help us in this task, we want to hear about it. For if you need a little more old-fashioned incentive, we tried an innovation. The State Department has launched a $10,000 innovation challenge. We ask for creative ideas about how you can use commonly available information devices to help verify that arms control treaties are being followed and to discourage cheating. Advances in information technology and social media may be able to directly support our disarmament and non-proliferation efforts. I'm certain that right here in the Bay Area, whether it's scientists in laboratories, engineers in Silicon Valley, professors at Cal, and yes, even Stanford, if they focus on these issues, we'll be able to develop even more effective and less costly solutions to the problems I've described. We've made real strides over the last decade in rising to the non-proliferation challenges at hand, but we have a long way to go, and we can get there if we have the sustained commitment of government, of industries, and of civil society. I wish it were possible to show all of you the dedicated efforts of literally thousands of people, not just in the State Department, but in the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense, our intelligence agencies, who work together with not just the best technological tools, but with everyday brilliance in seeking to detect how countries like Iran and North Korea and terrorist individuals pursue their goals. You'd be proud of your public servants, and you'd see it's money well spent. Public service is what it's about, not only for me, but for thousands of employees of the State Department. It's a great honor for me that I have with me here today my uncle, Ralph Countryman, who devoted a lifetime of public service to the U.S. Navy and the Alameda County Prosecutor's Office. And I think that you're also aware of the regional connection here of Ambassador Chris Stevens, who died in Benghazi, Libya, last month, together with three U.S. colleagues. Chris had a long, distinguished career in the Foreign Service, a riskier career than the path I took, and was one of our best experts on the Middle East. Before he went out to Libya at the start of the revolution early in 2011, Chris worked in my bureau. He directed the Office of Multilateral Nuclear and Security Affairs. He led our efforts on the global nonproliferation regime, including particularly the Nonproliferation Treaty and our cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency. You heard many of the resounding testimonials, including from his funeral this month here in the Bay Area. He was a great public service. He was a gifted and passionate diplomat, and he was a patriot who believed in America playing an active, positive role in the world. And he was a Californian through and through. So here is a great place for me to say that we owe it to Chris and to future generations of Americans like him not to pull back from the world's most difficult problems, but to make sure that we're doing all that we can do to build a safer, a more secure, and a more peaceful world. So thank you for taking time out of your day to listen to me. I hope that you'll keep in touch with the department and with the ISN Bureau through our real and virtual engagements. I am very happy to take all the questions you've collected. Thank you.
Well, our thanks go out to Assistant Secretary Tom Countryman, who directs the State Department Bureau of International Security and Nonproliferation. Very provocative remarks, I think, because it's a very provocative, not so much in a negative way, but in an energizing way, I would hope, topic. I think I was reminded of Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point, because I asked that the audience try to make my job easier by writing down some questions. I neglected to mention that there's a fine line between enough and too many. However, I'm also reminded that the Commonwealth Club prides itself on the most well-informed and interesting people, and these questions are clearly well-informed and very interesting. I'm actually not going to do what people often do and say take the moderator's prerogative and ask my own questions. I may weave them in, but there's so many here, I really want to try to address what people were interested in. I'm going to bundle a couple of them because the topics, I think, are very related. And the first three, really, ask about the nuclear power struggle, which I think is a good way of putting it, with Iran, with Pakistan, with North Korea, and, in fact, other potential nuclear aspirants in the world, and whether you see that playing out in a diplomatic or a military way. And a very related question was, which country do you fear the most of that set, Iran, Pakistan, North Korea? And finally, if Iran were to, in fact, develop a bomb or become, like North Korea, de facto nuclear state, what might we see? How might we respond?
Okay. Very simple questions. To review briefly where we are on the challenges that Iran and North Korea in particular pose in their pursuit of nuclear weapons technology. With Iran, I think in the last 4 years, we have attained a level of unity, of consensus in the international community, so that it is clear this is not a dispute between the United States and Iran. This is a dispute in which Iran has challenged the entire international community. And as a result, we've seen, as I mentioned, sanctions against Iran that we have never seen before, and that offer the promise for the first time of forcing the regime in Tehran to recognize that their economic well-being is at stake, and that will, we hope, not only force the Iranians to begin serious negotiations, but also enable the people of Iran, if they have access to information, to begin to question the choice that their leaders are making, that their leaders are pursuing either a nuclear weapon or, as they claim, trying to make a point of principle and doing it at the expense of ordinary individuals in Iran. I guarantee you the power centers in Iran are neither going hungry or losing any energy over the current sanctions. We will continue to pursue these negotiations. We will do it in the 5+1 framework, that is working with France, Britain, Germany, China, and Russia. We believe that there remains time and space for a successful diplomatic negotiation that would both respect the rights Iran claims to defend, but also give the world absolute confidence and verification that Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapons. There remains time for that. The time for that is not infinite, but it is, of course, our strong preference. If Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon, I have to express a fundamental disagreement with those who believe that this could potentially be a stabilizing factor in the Middle East. Iran remains a regime that has unsolved business and that has a belief that it can reshape the region according to its national interests. It is not the same situation as the kind of status quo strategic balance that obtained between the U.S. and the Soviet Union for so many years. And Iran with a nuclear weapon would be profoundly destabilizing, and that's why the president has made clear that he will not allow the development of such a weapon. North Korea is more difficult because of the even more opaque nature of the regime. We continue to seek to hold the North Koreans to the agreement reached in 2005 among the six different parties in that case, U.S., Russia, China, Japan, North Korea, South Korea, in which we committed to a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. There are indications that North Korea seeks to walk back from that commitment and seeks to have itself recognized as a nuclear weapon state. This is unacceptable to all of the parties that negotiated that agreement, and so we look for and we hope to see some positive recommitment from North Korea. We're always prepared for negotiations. We're not prepared for negotiations purely for their own sake, without some indication of a willingness for success on the part of the North Koreans. On Pakistan, I would only say this. We believe that it's part of the responsibility not only of the U.S. but of the world to assist Pakistan and India in reducing tensions, in reducing the risk of intentional or accidental nuclear exchange. Pakistan, as we know, has real security challenges and an internal challenge. Any country that has nuclear weapons should be concerned about that, and the Pakistani government is concerned and is showing the appropriate level of concern to maintain the security of those weapons. Which of those do I worry about most? I think I would have to say Iran, because of the belligerent rhetoric that comes from Iran, because of its readiness to use all the tools of national power, including terrorism, including surrogates, including overt military threats, and Iran that also had a nuclear weapon would be of most immediate concern to us. As the president said, that is a state of affairs we will not allow.
Thank you. I was reminded when you were discussing the North Korea a piece about the six parties, and obviously one of those six parties is China, and not, you know, all parties are equal, but some are more equal than others. We have a question about China, which I think is very important, which is what can be done to encourage relations with China to stay on high ground and avoid deteriorating into an arms race in the future? And I would add, in addition to our own bilateral rivalry or cooperation, China has immense capacity to help with nonproliferation or, by benign neglect, actually foster it. So I'm curious how we approach that.
I'm not an expert on China, but what I would say in the most general terms is that it's extremely important for not only government leaders, but analysts and academics in both China and the United States to realize that the other party is not acting only in order to frustrate us. There is a great tendency in China, and it has its mirror image within the United States, to believe that any action taken by the United States is aimed somehow at constraining China's rise. It's difficult for the Chinese to see economic measures that we take for our economic benefit as being something other than an attempt to heighten the competition economically. It is tempting in China to see our efforts to maintain strong economic and security relationships with almost all the countries of Asia. It is often seen in China as a threat or an effort to contain their influence. We do have to have a stronger dialogue that enables us to understand the economic and the security motives that each of us have, and to realize that for neither one of us is that other country at the very center of the universe. In particular, we've improved greatly, I think, our efforts to cooperate with China on non-proliferation issues. As you know, China has a booming high-tech industry, and it is a very tempting shopping mall for both Iran and North Korea as they seek high-tech materials and equipment to build ballistic missiles and nuclear technology. The Chinese are growing in appreciating that threat. They are determined not to be in violation of their Security Council resolution obligations, but they're also still building a capacity to have the kind of export controls that they need. So in this one particular area, we have very positive news in cooperation, but we have a long way to go. In other areas of nonproliferation and disarmament, the United States is taking more seriously than ever before the obligations that the five nuclear weapon states, China, Russia, Britain, France, the U.S., the obligations these P5 states have to consult and cooperate on our obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we meet regularly in this P5 format, and in that we find China to be a valuable and constructive partner.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Assistant Secretary Tom Countryman of the United States Department of State. He heads up the International Security and Nonproliferation Bureau that is responsible for preventing the spread of weapons of mass destruction and destabilizing conventional arms worldwide. I'd like to go with what I think is a very interesting question. It's also not something we hear about in the headlines so much. It's not about Iran. It's not about weapons being stolen or fissile material, but it is relevant. It's about other types of nuclear materials. Someone in the crowd mentioned that they were involved in the early commercialization of molybdenum-99 and also asks about technetium-99. Now, I know enough to be dangerous about isotopes and things nuclear, but the questioner asks, what are the prospects for continued supply of molybdenum and technetium-99 for medical applications? And I think what's behind this is that the production and transport and use of medical isotopes could potentially be a radiological threat or otherwise something that needs to be controlled. So maybe you can enlighten us.
It's partly that. I'd like to have my brother, the physicist, answer this question. But the I can't give you a full technical explanation, but in brief, molybdenum-99 in particular is a valuable isotope for medical treatment. And traditionally, it has been produced in reactors that are fueled by highly enriched uranium. One of our policy priorities and one that has been greatly supported through this nuclear security summit process, has been to encourage all nations to move away from the use of highly enriched uranium in research and medical isotope production reactors. The purpose of doing this, of converting a reactor designed for highly enriched uranium to a reactor designed for low enriched uranium, is to reduce the quantities of highly enriched uranium that are available in different countries, and therefore to greatly reduce the incentive that terrorists or others might have to get their hands on that highly enriched uranium. And we've made significant progress on this. We have agreement with a number of countries that are focused on shifting these production techniques. And at the same time, in order to give the international community confidence that this is a wise thing to do, we work with a number of countries on mechanisms to ensure the supply of molybdenum-99 and technetium to the medical isotope consumers around the world.
And now that I hear you explain that, I'm reminded, and this wasn't a State Department initiative, but the Department of Energy, I believe, talk about alphabet soup, had something called the RERTR program, which is reduced enrichment for research and test reactors. It's,
exactly.
It's a U.S. effort to do exactly what you described. Is if you don't have to use HEU in the reactor and you can use an alternative, that's what we want to do.
And I should emphasize when we say we, this is Department of Energy just as much as the Department of State working on this effort.
Well, now I'm going to ask a question. We had several in this vein that is about the public service you so eloquently described by your team, by people in the State Department, by Ambassador Stevens. Several questions on this front. And the first one, I think, is the most universal. In light of what just happened in Benghazi, what do you see as the security challenges for the State Department and the diplomatic corps post 9/11? There's a related question, which is what do you anticipate the greatest challenges of the State Department to be in the next 5 to 10 years? Now, maybe that's a global question. Maybe it's more related to nonproliferation. But
yeah. Both great questions and not easy to give a single answer. Even before 9/11, United States diplomats, those of us in the Foreign Service of the Department of State, which is only a few thousand people, keep in mind, this is not a big corps. This is smaller than the number of musicians employed by the Department of Defense. We've always believed that we have a dangerous but a necessary job. I had the privilege of serving in less dangerous places than Chris Stevens did. When he was in Jerusalem, I was in Rome. All of us realize that for the so-called glamour that comes with the life of a diplomat, there's a heavy cost to pay in terms of the sacrifice your family, your spouse, your children make. And there is always the risk of crime, of danger, and of terrorist attacks upon you as an individual or as a representative of the U.S. government. And perhaps the events of 9/11 have made the rest of the American people more conscious of those threats. And certainly an event like the death of four Americans in Benghazi last month again brings it home. But it has always been the case that we know what we're getting into. We accept the risks as well as we accept the rewards. And we do it because we genuinely believe that the United States' presence and influence is required not just in the biggest, most important countries. It's required in those places where the mere presence of the United States the words, the assistance that we bring, no matter how small, will make a difference to those people, to that country, to the benefit of both that struggling nation and to the United States. I don't think it will get easier, but I think that you have the determination of every Secretary of State, and I've had the honor to work for 8 fantastic ones, including 2 great Californians I was able to visit with this week, George Shultz and Condi Rice. Everyone is determined to protect their people and determined to seek from the Congress the funds that we need to protect our people. Biggest challenges for the State Department in the next 5 years, boy, that is sweeping. In regional terms, it will remain the challenge that Iran as a revisionist regime poses to the entire Middle East, as well as to the too long delayed search for a comprehensive two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. We've already talked about the ability to manage China's increasing economic strength and political influence in a way that is to the benefit of not only the United States and China, but to all of China's neighbors as well. And finally, I would say as a very general matter, the rise of new technologies is the most constant source of opportunities and threats to the United States. I could probably go on for a long time, but without illuminating you too much on that point. So I'll just say the rise of new technologies and the threats that they can bring to, for example, our information infrastructure, as well as the physical danger that new forms of weapons could potentially take.
Thank you. I believe we've come to the time in the program. We just have a couple of minutes left, so at the risk of the clock, I'm going to bundle a few questions. But again, I believe they're quite related. We've had several people ask about the other side of the coin, if you will, of nonproliferation, which is arms reductions and ultimately getting to zero. One question asks about if we have been educating leaders of other countries under the NPT as to why they don't need nuclear weapons. There's a question about the CTBT, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and does it weaken our position because we have not ratified it on the world stage? And then finally, not surprisingly, can we get to zero?
Okay. Let me take the question first about the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was signed by the United States but has not been ratified by the Senate. Senators expressed concern, this was 10, 12 years ago, that the notion of a comprehensive test ban, if we did not have the technology to verify it, could place the United States at a security disadvantage vis-a-vis Russia or other countries. We've worked hard on the technology. We are convinced that a comprehensive test ban is verifiable, and it is the intent of President Obama to resubmit the treaty to the Senate for ratification at the earliest feasible opportunity. The fact that we haven't ratified it is a handicap, but a small one, in our international credibility. Second, we do seek to educate other nations, not so much formally through the NPT framework, but through daily diplomatic work, to convince them that nuclear weapons are as much of a headache as they are an aspirin, that they do not contribute to the security of a number of states around the world, that it's economically infeasible, and that it invites greater security challenges for most countries than they're worth. And I think that over the years, the Non-Proliferation Treaty's success is based in part upon not just our success, but the growing consciousness in the world that this is not a path that rational countries should pursue when they have more pressing problems at home. Can we one day get to zero? I'm going to agree with my president and say yes. But I'm also going to emphasize it is a goal that we may not achieve in our lifetimes. It is a goal that requires advances in communication and in trust, and yes, also in technology between states that can only be accomplished in small steps, but that we believe is ultimately attainable. We owe that to future generations, and I am honored to be a small part of one of the more ambitious goals any president's ever set.
Great. Well, I'm going to reverse myself and take the moderator's prerogative at the end. And I did have a question or two of my own, and at the risk of maybe being the skunk at the garden party, it's a bit of a question on the stage of challenges that we face, that the U.S. faces. You spoke about the Nunn-Lugar program and the success over the last 20 years, and I would agree it's been a phenomenal success, not only in terms of limiting proliferation, but it's a bargain. It's incredibly cost-effective. It's cheap. Russia recently announced its intention to not renew, not sign up for another extension of the agreement. And this presents really some practical challenges, not only our own sort of intelligence with a small I, not spy stuff, but our presence on the ground at Russian sites, but a chill in the relationship. And I'm really curious to get your views on how large a chill that is, whether there are still practical things that can happen absent a formal Nunn-Lugar agreement.
Well, just for the background of the audience, for 20 years under the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program pioneered by Senators Nunn and Lugar, we have, at a relatively low cost, done some incredible work to reduce the threats of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons left over from the Soviet Union. Briefly, we've deactivated more than 7,000 nuclear warheads. We've helped the Russians to neutralize chemical weapons. We've helped them to put up effective safeguards and security around the places where fissile materials are stored. We've helped them convert laboratories that created weapons into peaceful use laboratories. And we've helped a lot of scientists whose entire career was nuclear or biological weapons to go into new productive fields. It has been a win-win for the United States, for Russia, and for the world. Recently, the Russians made a statement that they hope to see a renegotiation of the agreement under which we do this work. We are prepared to negotiate a new legal basis, and we've proposed some ideas to the Russians. We hope we can do that negotiation. We always prefer to do negotiations privately rather than through the newspapers. There's more work to be done. Russia's an excellent partner for us on these efforts, and we are committed to finding the right method, the right form, to continue our longstanding cooperation, not only within the Russian Federation, but elsewhere in the former Soviet Union and elsewhere in the world. I'm optimistic that we'll get there. You ask whether it's symptomatic of a larger trend in terms of U.S.-Russian cooperation. And I would say, first, that's a question for genuine Russian experts. But secondly, again, President Obama is determined that we will be a genuine partner with the Russian Federation, that we will seek to manage our relations and our cooperation not only in this field but across a range of fields in a respectful and cooperative manner. And we expect the same from the Russians, and I expect that's what we'll see.
Well, thank you very much. I think we also are fortunate to have Rose Gottemuller and Mike McFaul, our ambassador in Russia, have incredibly strong relationships with Russian partners. So I'm optimistic on that note as well. I want to conclude today's discussion and thank again Assistant Secretary Tom Countryman, the director of the International Security and Nonproliferation Bureau within the State Department. I also want to thank our audiences here in the room and on the radio, the television, and the internet. I'm Paul Carroll, the director of programs at the Plowshares Fund, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.